up, world? Welcome back to the 17th episode of the Hex and Cube podcast, a podcast where we talk about board games and the community that gathers around them. I am your host, Kyle Schubert, and tonight on a workshop episode, we have a very special guest, Andreas Odenthal, designer of La Granja, Solarius Mission, and Cooper Island. Welcome to the show, man. Really pumped to have you.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me. I'm really psyched to talk to you.
Good, man. I'm psyched too. So do you like to go by Oda, right? Is that your preferred nickname, if you will?
Yeah, that's what all my friends call me. And actually, my real name, Andreas, is only used by my family.
So awesome.
Everybody calls me Oda, so I just went for it.
Nice. Well, if you don't mind, I will call you Oda.
Yeah, sure.
Good. So, listeners, this is my new friend, Oda.
Hi.
Welcome, man.
Hi, Kyle. My new friend, Kyle.
Let's go.
Great meeting
you.
All right.
Yeah. It's good. Good to meet, thousands of miles apart via the internet. It's good stuff.
Yeah, the word grew very small.
Man, for real. Probably in some beneficial ways and in some not so beneficial ways.
You might be right about this.
So tonight, or today, mind you, I guess it's night where you are and yeah. It is the afternoon where I am. So we're just going to take some time to get to know Oda today, talk about his approach to game design and dig a little bit more specifically into his game Cooper Island. So let's get right into it. I always like to reiterate that humans are complex and they are multifaceted, and game design and board games are not all that we are. So I like to get to know folks a little bit better before we get into the game stuff. So, Oda, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself with regards to things other than games, you know, like where you're from, what you do to pay the bills, what are you interested in other than games, family stuff, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so I'm right now I'm 44 years of age, and I live in Germany, like you already mentioned. A little bit in the northern part of Germany, close to the Netherlands. It's only half an hour, and I can talk to Dutch people, for instance. So, what I do is to pay my bills is that I work as an assistant to a wheelchair driver or to several wheelchair drivers, depending on where I have to go. Basically, that's what I do. So I go to people and I help them live their life. And I live with them for maybe a day or maybe two. And yeah, I'm practically their assistant. So I do whatever they cannot do, which refers to all aspects of life. And that's just what I do. Yeah.
Yeah, I was curious. So, like, with the people that you work with, do you find that your relationship with them is, like, I guess, a business relationship? Or, like, do you get, like, I mean, do you feel like these people are your friends, right? Or is it more of a, you are my job kind of thing? How do you approach that?
I think you cannot see this black and white. It's always shades of gray. So at some point, you are very friendly. This is a job that you have to deal with people, and you have to at some point deal with personal things, of course. And I would not actually consider them my friends like other people that I went to school with, for instance, or something like this. But we are very close.
Mm.
and we share interests. We go to the cinema, to football games, and so on. So this is basically you cannot say it's one or the other. It's always a mixture of everything. So at some point, you have to say, okay, this is just my job. When I come home, I'm out of my job, and then I have to deal with my normal life. And then you have to put some kind of the job has to have its limit. Otherwise, you take your problems back home. But I think that's true for every job. So, sure. I think every people that or people that work in such a job, they know that there's very personal stuff happening, and also that you have to draw a line at some point.
Yeah, makes sense. Yeah, so what else are you into? What does your life look like?
So I don't have a family with kids. I'm married, but we don't have kids, but we have many animals. So we are the animal people, you could say. And we have 5 dogs. We have 1 goat. We used to have 2 goats a couple of months ago, but Emma got sick and died. So we only have 1 goat left. We have close to 20 chicken. And we have some cats running around here. I think the actual number is 3, but 1 is on the way from Spain to Germany, and will arrive soon. So we will get a new tomcat here from a Spanish shelter. It's actually it's the same shelter that Cooper was from.
Ah, cool, yeah. Cool.
So the dog Cooper is the reason why my game is named Cooper Island, and the dog that is on the starting player token, that's actually our dog Cooper, and there's a little story in the game about Cooper, and so all the animals that are living with us are from animal welfare at some point. So the chicken are from what is it called, from egg laying factories.
Oh yeah.
And they were rescued is maybe not the right term, but yeah, maybe they are rescued because in Germany, I don't know, I think this is the same in America, when the chicken get too old, they become unproductive and they were killed. And there's a an association here in Germany who takes over these animals, and they look for homes for these chicken where they can live for the rest of their life instead of being shredded. And some of them live with us now.
Man, that's cool. That's so cool. Actually, yeah. It's crazy that you bring that up, the egg-laying facilities. So I work for a company that manufactures food products, and part of my job is to just research the industry and to know the market. And I was just doing some research on various livestock facilities and, you know, egg laying facilities, and some of it is pretty brutal, man. So that's cool that you're able to go in and provide a home for some of those animals. That's cool.
Yeah, I think so too. And I always tell them that they don't have to lay eggs anymore. If they don't want to, they don't have to. Yeah. They are done laying eggs. They did this for 1 year like hell. And yep. If they don't want to, there's no stress here. They can just live here. And if they are old enough, they can die in peace. And they don't have to do anything except being a happy chicken.
Yeah. That's cool, man. That's good.
Yeah, so that's basically where I live or how I live, and yeah, and cool. Of course, we play many games.
Yeah, and do you have any other hobbies or interests like that outside of board games?
Yeah, my biggest interest is certainly music.
Ah, so, cool.
Yeah, this is and eating, I guess. Yeah.
That's perfect. So, so I also love eating. I also love cooking. I enjoy, well, it's kind of shifted a little bit recently just because of our schedules, but, I was doing, most of the cooking, for our family just because I enjoyed it so much. But, because of our schedules, my wife has been doing a lot more cooking. Mm. But that was one of the things that I wanted to ask you was, you know, what are some foods that are kind of native to your area of the world that you really enjoy? Like what's some of your favorite German dishes? Because I wouldn't be probably very familiar with many of them. So tell me about that. What do you like to eat?
Yeah, actually, I thought about this because you sent me this question up ahead, and I thought I really don't know if they are native to Germany, but something that my mother used to make us as children, and I still love to the bone, is apple pancake. So this, I think that's different from the pancakes which I think I know from America. These are smaller pancakes, and in Germany, we make pancakes that they are the size of a pizza.
Oh my gosh!
But it's very flat, flat pancake, and you just put sliced apples on it, and then you turn it around so everything gets baked good, and then there's sugar on top, or maybe some what is it called? Let me just look it up. Cinnamon, I guess. Yeah, cinnamon.
Yeah.
You can put some cinnamon on it, and then it's a traditional family dish that when I grew up.
That sounds delicious.
Yeah. But I think that's not very German. I don't know. I thought about something that is very German, and I don't know. Red cabbage? Red cabbage is something that is very unique here, I guess, but I don't know. We have some special sausages. I don't know if what they are called in English, if there's something that's like, yeah, I think it's basically Bratwurst. It's a fresh meat that's in the sausage. Like what's the term, like hash, minced meat? I don't know. I'm just looking stuff up because I don't know the English terms for this. So it's basically a sausage that has fresh meat in it, and that gets cooked, and you eat mashed potatoes and red cabbage with it. It's something that also I ate a lot while growing up.
That also sounds delicious, and I think that probably is more native to German. That's not something I think that is probably very common in the States.
No, we have some pancake restaurants here in Germany, and also in the Netherlands. I was it was a couple of years ago. We were in the Netherlands, and there was also a pancake house, and they had the same style of pancakes, which are, you can also put meat on it and vegetables and something like this, and then there's a cheese on top. I don't think that's comparable to American pancakes, which are basically drowned in maple leaf maple juice, right?
Yeah, we just like stack a few of them on top of each other and drown them. They take a bath in syrup.
Yeah, that's nothing that we do here. Maybe we don't live close enough to Canada. I don't know.
I'm sure that's it. Yeah, that question would be really hard for an American, I think, because I don't know if we have anything that is native to America. We just take stuff from other cultures and other nations and I don't know, make them cheaper and then sell them in fast food places. That's what we do.
Yeah, fast food is maybe this is original to America, fast food.
Yeah, there you go. Okay. That's awesome. So then my other question was about music, because I also love music. And so first of all, do you play any instruments? Do you play any music?
Well, back in the days, I played the bass guitar, and I also played in a band, and but that's basically it. And sometimes I play guitar, acoustic guitar, just for myself a little bit, but nothing serious. I just learned everything by myself, so no real skill level here. Just good enough to play in a punk band, you know.
Oh, let's go! You're in a punk band.
Well, I was back when I was a little bit younger. I played in a hardcore band.
Dude, that's awesome! So, yeah. That's kind of my. I mean, you're a little bit older than I am, so you probably got to experience a little bit more of the punk and hardcore scene as it was developing. Versus me coming in later into it. But so what kind of, you're obviously into that kind of music. What are some bands that you like?
Yeah, so basically I like, maybe you can say, handmade music. If there's an artistic approach to the music, so that the people that are actually the artists behind this, they create the music. That's basically something that I find appealing in music. I love all kinds of music, but I'm actually drawn to more like guitar driven, heavier music, like punk rock, hardcore, or even indie rock or something like this. So, some of my favorite bands. Well, I always have to say that Helmet is one of my most favorite bands of all time. I'm certain of that.
Okay.
Do you know Helmet?
I don't.
You don't know Helmet? That's
I don't know Helmet. I'm going to have to check them out, though, now.
they came into life at the end of the 80s and had their prime time was maybe the 90s. And then they split up and they got older and they are still around. And actually I saw them live 3 years ago for the first time in my life. And I think I cried at some point during the gig. It was really moving, because I am in love with this band for almost 25 to 30 years now. No, 30 years, not 25. Let's just say 25. And seeing them live in a small club in Germany, maybe 150 people were there, and it was very intimate, and the band was so good. It was just great.
That's awesome. You still run around in the circle pit or stage dive or anything?
No, I recently saw an image that somebody sent to me. It was Punk's Not Dead. We just stand in the background, and it's basically true. And you might add that we sip our beer in peace without being smashed in the face any longer.
Man, yeah. I do miss shows though. It's one of the many unfortunate happenings of the last year. But that's awesome, man.
The fun thing about this is when I played in a band, we had a singer, a woman singer, and at some point we lost each other, because she moved to Denmark, and later what I now know that she moved to the Netherlands, and finally she came back to Germany and here in the region again, and we met through board games, because and there's also another guy that I used to play in a band with, and I met him at a local gaming store, and I said, what are you doing here? I know you from something else. And yeah, he was into board games as well, and so some of the old people that were in hardcore bands and punk bands back then, I met again through board gaming, and that was really fun. And now we started to go to concerts again as the same people from back in the days, knowing each other through board games again and starting to go to shows again. That's really fun.
That is awesome. That's a great story. Are you guys going to start up a band again?
No, I don't think so.
Sometimes I
think about it, but yeah, it's weird.
Dude, getting older is it's interesting.
Yeah, these are people I met 20 years ago and I played in a band with 20 years ago, and that's how old I am. Am I allowed to curse here on the show?
Yeah, you're fine, man. Yep.
That's how beep old I am.
Yeah. I'll put some like crazy noise over it. I don't know.
Yeah.
I always have this like totally unrealistic dream of starting a band again and getting back into it. And I'm like, oh, that would be great, but man, not gonna happen.
So I guess you're into this kind of music too, like more heavier music, or what's your favorite type of music?
Yeah, so I also love all kinds of music. Some of my favorite artists, I think, of all time are like R&B vocalists and artists. Mm. But yeah, when I was just out of high school, I was into heavier music. Mostly at that time, it was mostly like metalcore stuff. And then over time, I got introduced into more like punk and hardcore stuff. Mm. But I was able to tour around the States with a metalcore band, and then I was able to do vocals for like a local band for a little while.
Oh, which one? Which one metalcore band? Maybe I know them.
The band that I toured around the country with?
Mm-hmm.
They were called For Today.
For Today? No, I haven't heard of them.
Yeah. So for their, well, that's what's funny about all these genres of music is like with every genre, there's 50 subgenres.
Yeah.
And they all kind of have their own, I guess followings of people or kind of sub cultures of people. And so for their subculture, they did pretty well. They were able, I think, to tour internationally a few times. And so, it was good times.
I hear you.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. We have that in common.
Great. There's a reason why we became friends, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. So we can talk a little bit about game stuff now.
Yeah, sure.
Why don't we start off? I'd love to just, I guess, get a little bit of an intro on how you were introduced to board games, and then also how you started designing games. What brought you to that point?
Mm-hmm. So I was always interested in board games, but while growing up, I had different hobbies. I was heavy into sports. I played table tennis and handball at the same time. And also were pretty much into music. And at some point that shifted. So when I started a relationship with what now is my wife, we started playing games together as a couple. So this is how we were introduced into games. We went to a store and checked some games out, and then we put them on the shelf because they were way too complicated for us. So it took us a couple of months to finally be able to understand what these games are about. And when we finally played them, we were blown away. And we wanted to have more of these games. The first game we played back then was the Settlers card game. Okay. It's a pure two-player game, and it's still one of my favorite games. But that was basically the starting point. And 2 or 3 years into the hobby, we realized that there's a huge fair around these shores here. We live close to Essen. It's around about 1 hour, maybe a little bit more, with a car to Essen. And so we thought, oh, go, let's check this fair out that's in Essen once a year. And wow, that was crazy. Yeah, and then we continued. We bought more games. We played many games. And yeah, at some point, I was there was some guy that I knew from a board game forum on the internet, and he said that he wanted to start a company. And coming from a do-it-yourself background, from hardcore and punk rock music, I thought, okay, this guy is going to start his own publishing company and maybe he needs some help. So I offered him to explain the game that he's going to publish in Essen. And he said, okay, what does this guy want from me? I don't know this guy. And then we had a talk and we learned, became friendly. And he said, okay, he seems harmless and he maybe just wants to help me. And so I did. And the game that I explained on the fair was At the Gates of Luoyang in Essen, the game by Uwe Rosenberg. And in the process of preparing for the fair, I met Uwe and we talked about board games and he playtested with me. And he, after our talk, well, basically I interviewed him for a German online blog. And after that, he said, here's a Luoyang prototype. Do you want to play the playtest the solo variant? And I said, well, that's great, because I was really into solo gaming back then. And I loved Agricola and I loved Le Havre. And yeah, so I playtested the Luoyang solo mode and I gave feedback to the publisher. And that was my introduction into what later became having new ideas of your own and maybe design a game by myself. And yeah, a couple of years later, that's what I did.
Wow. So not everybody has a intro into board game design quite like that one. So that's cool.
Yeah, the good thing about this is that Uwe lives very close to me as well. So it's 2 hours with the car, and we met in a town halfway, so we could talk and playtest and stuff like that. And yeah, it was very good for me to live here in Germany close to these people and to meet them and get friendly with them. It was a very very good for me as a designer, of course, that the chances that one of my games, if it's good enough, gets published were pretty high as soon as you know some people in the business.
That's cool. I wanted to ask you something, just kind of going back to how you even got into board games in the first place. Because I live in the States, and so my context is that, and I do research and I learn about what happens in the rest of the world, but I still have a very limited perspective on how things are elsewhere. I remember growing up and like we had some board games, right? You know, we had like Monopoly and Sorry and whatever, but like board games weren't really, I don't know, I didn't really feel like they had a place in the culture. Like, I don't know, but would you say that it was maybe common or more normal to have these types of board games in Germany? Was that more just kind of part of the culture to have board games be a part of families and a part of your lives?
Well, the family games in Germany are basically not the ones like Catan or Carcassonne, these are very, very rarely found in a family. So normally the classics here, board games that are classical family games that are basically, what is it called? In Germany, it's called Mensch, ärger dich nicht. Oh, let me just look it up. It's, everybody knows it. I heard the English name. It's basically you run around, you throw dice, and then you kick other people's out. And as soon as you have all your figures in this in this right spot, you're basically won. The Swiss version is Dog, I guess. It's called Dog.
Okay. Interesting. I honestly don't know if I'm familiar with that.
Yeah, you are.
It almost sounded like Parcheesi.
Parcheesi is the whole world knows it under the name Parcheesi, and in Germany it's called Mensch, ärgere dich nicht, which is translated to guy, don't be mad about something, because in this game you get kicked out all the time and you have to go back to start. And so basically the title of the game is don't be mad about being kicked in the butt all the time.
That's awesome. Okay.
Parcheesi is a typical German game, and Monopoly, of course, or Risk.
Okay. So I guess it's more similar than I would have thought originally.
Yeah. In the 90s, games were growing a little bit more popular because of the success from Settlers of Catan. But normally, German family that has not parents who are totally into board games, they don't play something like this.
So okay.
it's more of a hobby thing here.
Great. So I love learning. That's good. Good to know. So one thing that I like to ask, especially designers, I just think it's a fun question, is like, who are some designers that you're into right now?
Who I'm into? Of course, Vladimir Suchi, of course, because I really love Underwater Cities, which became one of my favorite, my most favorite game. Really fast, and by now this is really not happening all the time, but we played this game 140 times by now.
Oh my gosh.
This was the game in the first lockdown here in Germany last year. We played it sometimes three times a day. That was really wild, and so this game became a really, really one I really love. And Vladimir designs very good games that I like. He has a style that I like very much, and yeah, he's certainly one of them.
Have you played his? Have you played Praga?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like this very much too. But it's different from Underwater Cities because it's more strategic, and but it's also very good. Very, very good. It has the same game feel because you get these small bonuses all the time. A bonus here, bonus there. If you do this, you get this bonus. If you do this, you get this bonus. And this is something that I really like. And of course, I love the games by Uwe Rosenberg, of course, which were Agricola and Caverna especially. I love Caverna even more than Agricola, but... I think Fields of Ale is, for instance, is my favorite game from Uwe. And of course, Stefan Feld. And I'm happy to know all these guys by now. And he's a very, very great designer because he's so unique in his approach to games. Great ideas. And I feel that most of his games have this small, unique idea in them. And that's something Stefan does really, really well.
You know, that's very interesting because I would have guessed that you studied under Feld after I played La Granja. I felt very much Feld in that design, and so that's cool that you mention him.
Yeah, I had the opportunity because after At the Gates of Lo Yang was published by my friend, who's by now my friend Ralf. He's doing this publisher here in Germany. I told you the tourist just a couple of minutes ago. It's called Hall Games. He's doing Hall Games, and he works very close with Stefan by now. And after publishing At the Gates of Lo Yang by Uwe Rosenberg, the second game he was working on was what would later become Luna. And with Luna, I was involved in the development for the first time, really close, because, and actually, if you have the game and you look on the backside of the cover, you could see that I'm listed as one of the editors of the game, which is basically very nice of Ralf mentioning me there, because he's the guy who did the whole work, and I helped a lot, but it was very nice of him to mention me there. But Luna is basically the game that when I learned the craft, you know, I learned so much from working with Uwe, and I learned even more. The next step was learning from Ralf being an outstanding editor and Stefan being an outstanding designer. And I learned from Uwe Rosenberg, I learned from Stefan Feld, and I learned from Ralf Bruhn. And back when I designed La Granja together with Mike, this was basically the period of time that I came out of when Luna was published. Then I started having my own ideas, and then La Granja was born. And later in the process of developing La Granja, I asked Stefan if it would be okay that I take his Luna temple mechanism and shape it into something slightly different and use it again in La Granja. And he said, that's perfectly fine. Use whatever you want. And yeah, maybe that's why you have the felt thing going here at La Granja.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. Well, man, those are some great people that you were able to, able to learn from and spend time with.
Yeah, that's cool. Very much true. That's very much true.
So let's talk a little bit about your approach, your personal approach to designing.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, what is your philosophy of design? Like, do you have any ideals, if you will, that you try to bring into every design of yours? And and an example would be: do you want all of your games to be very thematic, or do you want all of your games to have a huge player count, or do you want there to be a lot of direct player interaction, or something like that? What's kind of your philosophy of game design? How do you approach it?
Yeah, this is actually something that I developed while playtesting with Uwe very much, because this is a lesson I learned from him. Basically, my approach to game designing is not about mechanics, about theme, or whatever. It's about game feel. So what do I want the players to feel, to experience while playing the game? And that's basically what I want to create. So when you play a game of mine, I'm pretty certain that you will have very similar game feel all the time, because this is basically what I'm aiming for. So I want you to slip on your chair while waiting for the next turn, that you cannot wait for your next turn. So you're desperate to move again and to create this game feel. And also, I grew up my gaming socialization was playing many Alea games from the German publisher Alea. And the concept behind these Alea games was always that playing turns or downtime was very reduced. So for instance, when you play Puerto Rico, which is one of the most famous games from the publisher, the basic mechanism in this game is a mechanism that includes all players all the time. There are no waiting phases. So one player takes a role and everybody gets to play the role. So in these games, and that's basically a philosophy you can find in most Alea games, very reduced downtime. And that's also something that I always try to achieve. I don't know if I succeed by doing so, because I guess Cooper Island has some downtime, especially in the last couple of rounds. But basically, that's what I'm aiming for here. So I want to create a certain game feel at some point. And then another point here to create this game feel is that you have much freedom at what you want to do. This is every time or any time actions that you have in La Granja and you have in Cooper Island as well, that you can do certain stuff while doing the main action. You have many options moving around stuff, even though this is not part of the action. And this gives players so much freedom in their choice. And how do I want to achieve a goal here? I'm always trying to make it possible that you can do whatever you want. I'm not restricting players. I want them, if you want to do something, there is a way in my games. And I'm not normally the designer who says, you want to do this? Yeah, you can't. You cannot do this. You have to find a way to go around this. That's not something I do, because I want players always to be able to do they want to do. And the only thing you have to find out is, how do I get there? And is it worth doing it? Because if you're doing it not as optimal as other players, you will certainly lose. And that's the other aspect in the games that I want to achieve. I want that a skilled player will always beat a beginner player, because you just play better. There has to be some kind of randomness always, but if you're doing it right, you will normally win because you're just the better player, because you know the game. Or if there's a very skilled player and who has the ability to, even in games that he or she does not know already, still be very, very good, very skilled player, these players, they should win because they do something right, you know? Like, there's a certain amount of luck in the games or randomness, but in the end, the skilled player should always win. And this is also something that I want to achieve here in the games. And also huge replayability, because I told you how many times we played Underwater Cities. This is actually something that I always try to find in games, that this game I can play over and over and over again. And every time I play it, I can play it differently and I can experience something new. And if I like this game, then I want to play it all the time. And it still be thrilling to me. That's something that I want to have in my games. And
yeah, that's awesome. Those are great philosophies, if you will, or just a great approach. It's cool that so in Cooper Island, it's been a while since I've played La Granja, and it's funny. So you pronounce La Granja, La Granja, yeah.
Yeah, the right pronunciation of the game is La Granja.
La Granja.
La Granja. But La Granja. To a German tongue, this is very complicated. And in order to not break it, I'm always using the German J, La Granja.
Gotcha. So yeah. It's funny, I did some research on trying to learn how to pronounce the title of the game. And was I didn't come to a great conclusion because it's pronounced differently depending on what language you approach it from. So, so that's good to hear you pronounce it. But it's been a while since I've played La Granja.
very good.
Thanks. But in Cooper Island, certainly there was the feel of, I know that if I play this more, I will get better at it.
Yeah.
So you certainly achieved that with Cooper Island. Hmm. So that's awesome. That's great. So yeah. So since we're already into Cooper Island, let's talk a little bit more about it. That's definitely my most recent play of one of your games. And for those that are not familiar with the game, I think it's fun to hear the designer's kind of elevator pitch, if you will, about the game. So what is Cooper Island? Tell us a little bit about it.
Oh, my God. What is Cooper Island? Yeah, so I'm really not good at pitching games because, I don't know why. But so the basic, maybe... I don't know. You might have to edit this stumbling out of the podcast, but let me just start over. So what you do in Cooper Island is that you get to build the players were exploring an island, and each player has their own peninsula on this island. And what you do on this peninsula is that you puzzle landscape tiles on this island. And by puzzling these landscape tiles, you gain resources. But the twist on this puzzling mechanism is that you do not only just lay the tiles flat on the island and then you gain resources, you also can stack the tiles itself onto each other so that you gain higher levels, like in a three-dimensional way. And when you place, for instance, a forest landscape on the island on level 3, then you will put a brown cube on it because it's wood. The resource is called wood that you get in the forest. And since it is on level 3, the value of this cube is 3. If the level that the cube is on is a higher level, like 4 or 5, the value of the cube is higher, like 4 or 5. So by gaining higher levels in this game, you gain more valuable resources. And that is a mechanism that is defining for this game, I guess. But you need something to use the resources. So you build statues on this island, you build buildings, you build more ships that you can gain income from, and you can... find gold in the mountains, and you can use this gold to sell it to trade ships and gain victory points. And especially on the trade ships, you get these small anytime actions that I'm always implementing in my games. But the other main aspect of this game, I guess, is the victory point track, because it's very special how you count your victory points in this game. And what you do is that the whole island that you play with other people, it consists of a middle board and one peninsula per player. And you puzzle everything together in a way that the setup is right for the right player account. So, for instance, when we play just the two of us, we have two peninsulas and the middle place where the worker placement is done. But when we play with three players, you have three peninsulas and the middle place. So the shape of the island is always different when you play the game. But what's always the same is that there is water around this island. And the water around this island is basically a victory point track. And you will use two small ships. The one ship will go clockwise around the island, and the other ship will go counterclockwise around the island. So... the whole water around the island is divided into small sequences, and you move your ship when you gain helm points in this game. And each helm point is basically a victory point But that's not so special. But what makes it special is that you can place special eyelet tiles on this or this water track. And when you reach one of these eyelets with one of your ships, you gain the action that is printed on the eyelet. So by getting by gaining victory points, you also gain small bonus actions. And since each player does this on their own peninsula, your victory point ships might even leave your personal area and move around the island, and they will go to the peninsulas of the other players. And when you go there, the other players also have islet tiles around their peninsula. And when you reach those islets, you will gain their actions as well. So what you do in this game is to collect victory points, is that you move your ships around the island and gain bonus actions. So the victory point track is not only for this dead currency of victory points, it's also part of the game. And this is actually something that my wife came up with, and it was a brilliant idea, so I went for it.
So it sounds like you should have your wife designing more of your games, I think.
Yeah, that's basically true. But she doesn't have the time, so I have to do it.
Shucks. The victory point system, if you will, is very clever. And you know, in most games, there's it seems like there's an attempt to find a balance between like intermittent scoring and then end game scoring, right? But there's what this system does in Cooper Island that is very fascinating is that it really encourages the intermittent scoring versus the end game scoring because of those additional bonuses that you can get if you move along the track.
Yeah.
So it's very fascinating, and I love that aspect of the game.
Yeah, this is actually a reflection of what I was trying to tell you before when you asked about the philosophy behind my game designs. You know, I said I'm always for the one who wants to create a certain game feel. Mm. And what I really don't like is victory points. I think victory points are the most boring currency in a game because it's basically dead. You cannot do anything with it. A victory point is not feeding your engine. It gets you nothing except winning. So normally, there's only one player who is happy to get victory points, and that's the winner. And each other player, they say, okay, I got second place, I got third place, but who cares? And this is not fun because only one player has the most fun, and that's the one who's winning. And what I'm trying to create is a game feel of winning is not so important. Important is that everybody at the table is having fun. And so what I so much liked about this idea from my wife that she said, put bonuses on the victory point track. And I said, that's incredibly brilliant because in this case, victory points become part of the game. They are not just there for determining a winner. They are part of the fun of this game. And this is actually the perfect example about what I'm trying to create. I want everybody to be involved in the game and have fun playing it while playing it and not just determining a winner. Victory points are incredibly boring. Nobody wants them because you want to play. You don't want to have a dead currency that is worth nothing except for glory, maybe. But who wants glory anyway? You want to have fun. And that's what I'm trying to achieve.
Yeah, that's wonderful. So with Cooper Island, well, I guess first of all, as a comment to your description, the game, at least from my perspective, is very strategic and very tight. At least your first couple times playing it.
Yeah.
And I think that plays into the skilled player winning, right? If you're able to play the game more and practice, if you will, You will be able to refine your strategic capabilities, and the game may still feel tight, but it will feel a little bit more manageable, I guess, or like you at least know what you're doing. Mm. You know, the first time you play the game, you get through half the game and you're like, I made a mistake and I am not where I want to be. And so I love that. First of all, I actually love games that it almost feels like you are getting curb stomped for a duration of the game. And that may sound very odd, and some people may hear that and go, wow, that sounds horrible.
What's the term? Curb stomp?
Yeah, you listen to hardcore. You should know that too. So getting kicked in the teeth.
Okay. Yeah.
It almost is similar. So when I play In the Year of the Dragon.
That's a hard game.
Yeah. So there is this tightness where you just feel like it's hard to describe, but it's just, you're like, you're pushing and pushing and pushing, right? It's very challenging. Mm-hmm. And the first time you play Cooper Island, or at least the first time I played it, I felt a little bit of that. And that gets relieved as you play the game and learn the systems more. But it is tight. Every decision that you make is very meaningful and very important.
Yeah.
Nothing is fluff. Nothing is, you know, it's not just there just to be there. It has a purpose. And if you have an idea of where you want to go earlier in the game, you will do much better than if you discover that later in the game.
Yeah, that's actually part of this strategic approach that I was trying this time. And it's basically the first islet tile that you place while preparing the game, while starting the game, is one of the most important decisions that you do in the game, because it will lead your path at least for the first two rounds.
Mm.
So what islet tile do I want to play first? Do I want to play the one that gets me a statue, which will lead to building statues in the first two rounds? Or do I want to build a boat? Then I need money and wood. This is basically the decision. What you are aiming for is being made before you even start the game.
Mm.
And as soon as you understand that you have to decide on this, even before playing the game, especially considering your position in the game, in playing order. And then you look at the milestones and what you get your first worker for. That's basically the first thing you do. You want to go for the milestones to get more workers, to get more stuff done. So this is basically a very strategic approach here. And if you don't do this, the game will get very hard, and it's a learning curve that you have to go through. Yeah, that's very much true.
Yeah, and I love it. And just as a compliment too, so we had a weekend not too long ago where we were able to play a whole lot of games, and Cooper Island was one of them, and I taught it to a few close friends. And it was in that weekend, we also played games like the Stalfour Dynasty. We played Gugong. We played Bonfire. We played a whole heap of great games. And one of my friends said that Cooper Island was his favorite of the weekend. And he even said by far. So way to go.
Yeah, great. That's good to hear. Very, very nice. Yeah, I'm always a little bit worried about that the threshold to go over here in this game is very high. When you experience a first play that is so frustrating, you might not even play it a second time. That's really something that maybe is a little bit of a flaw in the game, that it is too harsh on new players.
Mm.
But I think it's always helpful when a skilled explainer, like I assume you are, and since you like the game, it's also helping that you want to explain it very good to your friends. And maybe that's the reason why your friends don't have this problem learning the game, because there's a skilled explainer at the table. It's always helpful. So that might be beneficial to the reception.
Well, and I mean, not every game isn't for every person, right?
Yeah, true, absolutely true.
And we, you know, as a designer, you can't, well, you can try to appeal to every taste, right? Mm. There are games that maybe get close to that, or they try to appeal to as many tastes as possible, right? From what I can tell, that's not necessarily your intent, right? Your intent is not necessarily to make a game that appeals to as many tastes as possible necessarily. Well, at least maybe from a financial standpoint. You always want people to play your games and enjoy them. But
yeah, that's
but true. You have an idea of kind of who may enjoy the game and who may not enjoy the game, right?
Yeah, that's basically a very twisted view on this, is that I actually think that I really don't care who likes my game. Yeah. But it's the most important thing to think about it as well. So if you like the game, you should have the best experience playing it. So there should be very, very good and very thematically interwoven rules that you can understand the game very good. But if you don't like this certain game, I have no problem with this. There's so many brilliant games. There's so many creative and talented designers out there. You will find the game that you love the most. And yeah, so don't play Cooper Island. Play a different game. Play Bonfire. I love Bonfire to the bone. Even Gugong as well is one of my favorite game from the last couple of years. And you will find what you want to play. Just play what you love the most. And if you don't like Cooper Island, no problem. I just want you to have fun with board games. And if you like Cooper Island, I'm happy.
Yeah, come on.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. So with Cooper Island, did you, you know, you don't have to go into a whole origin story, but during the like early stages of the game, and I'm saying like way early, like what was one of the initial concepts for the game? Did you start with like the peninsula concept? Was that kind of the start of the game, or did you have the, I guess, worker placement mechanism? Like, how did this game start?
Okay, you want a little bit deeper here in this, because I'm just telling you the story, because I think I want to tell it again, so it's fine. When I was starting designing games, I had many, many talks with Uwe Rosenberg, and we playtested the heck out of his games. And while playtesting his games, I learned so much from him about his designing philosophies and how he approaches games. And of course, he was kind of mentoring me for a certain time. And he said once to me, the hardest thing, and I think it's absolutely true what he told me back then, the hardest thing is to have an idea and to get it to the table.
Mm.
The most important thing, that you don't sit around and fantasize about something. You have to get it on the table and play it. And it doesn't matter if it's a copy of something or not. You just have to start really playing the game, and then you have something you can work with. And of course, that you can get your inspirations from other games, but you have to shape it into something different during the development. So his take was basically take, what's your favorite game? He asked me, and I said, it's Puerto Rico. Okay, take the main mechanism from Puerto Rico, use it exactly like it is in the game, and then design a whole different game around it. And then you can, then you have a starting point that you really sit at the table and you play something and not just fantasizing about it. And that's the most important thing. And that's a very hard, step to achieve. So what I made a habit of, being a huge hip hop fan as well, I love to get inspirations from other games. So maybe I'm always trying to come up with this hip hop story of that you that a hip hop song is basically something old in a new clothes. So what hip hop artists do, they cut from other records and they turn old songs into new songs. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's basically what I'm trying to do, is that I get inspirations from other designers and their beautiful ideas. And I take what I like of them and I shape them into something that I really love. So, and it also has to have a different game feel. So it's not just copying something. So that's what I was trying all the time. And you can certainly get this approach when you played La Grania. You know that. Maybe you thought about this also, that Glory to Rome was the initial to design this game here. With the multi-use cards. It's such a brilliant concept of the multi-use cards, and I wanted to use this in a completely different game. And that's my take on this. And with Cooper Island, once I played a game by the Fragor brothers. It's team, a British designer team, and they designed a game that's called Antics. You know the game?
I've heard of it. I don't know much about it, though.
So this is basically that you, the main drive in this game is that you build an anthill, and this anthill consists of double hex tiles that you place like an anthill. You know, there are different levels in the anthill, and in this game, the levels, the tiles, they show actions. And the higher the level in this game where you place your worker on, the better is the action. So for instance, you move around your ants on the in this game on the board, and if you take the move around action and you take the action on level 4, you can move around 4 times. If you place this action on level 2, you can move around 2 times. So I really loved this mechanism as an action selection mechanism, and I thought the initial to design Cooper Island was that I wanted to turn this mechanism into something that you gain resources for. That was always the idea, that you have a puzzle, a kind of puzzle in a three-dimensional way, and the level of the landscapes determines the value of the resource. That was my take. I wanted to shape this from action selection to resource generation. And this was basically the idea. And then I thought about it. Well, the next step was, okay, this has to be an island that you can explore, that you can, where you can find resources on, and then you puzzle on your island. And at some point, the island is completed, and that might be the end of the game at some point. So this was the initial idea. And the next idea was, of course, that there's always water around an island, and that you can move a ship around this island. And that was the idea, to count your victory points with a ship that's moving around your island. And then my wife came along and said, okay, let's put some bonus actions on the waters, that you, when your ship goes there, you can reach the island and you can do the bonus action. And so this was basically how the game started. And yeah,
that's awesome. Yeah, the building of the peninsula is very clever and very just fun. Like, it's just fun to place the tiles on the board, you know, place the tiles on the board and build up your peninsula. Like, that it's like the child in you comes out, and you just enjoy, you know, making this little island of yours. Did you ever play around with a shared island where people are building up the same area?
At some point, I was thinking about it, but I made the decision very early in the development that this generating of resources should be the engine that will fuel your game.
Gotcha.
And I don't want people to mess up my engine. So this resource generation that is only my stuff.
And love it.
Yeah, this was a very early take on it. But yeah, of course, I can see that this can work in a game where I think there are also, you know, like Java from Kramer Kiesling has a three-dimensional tiling mechanism.
Yeah.
And that's on a shared board.
Yeah, it creates a totally different game, right? It's not Cooper Island. Like if you would have made that decision, it would have, like you were talking, the feel of the game, the experience would have been very different, I think.
Mm.
So...
Yeah,
did
what I wanted to add to this what we just talked about with that Cooper Island has can be very frustrating for new players, and that you can maybe not score as much points as you are used to in games. What I was trying to create here was also that when you look at your peninsula at the end of the game, even you might have just earned 15 or 20 points, which is actually not the best score in this game, then you still have something that you can look on and say, okay, I created this. It looks beautiful. I built a statue. I built a house. It scored poorly, but at least I created this. And it looks really, really rewarding. And that's something I wanted to achieve as well.
Yeah, I actually... with this gaming weekend where I taught it to my friends, I think that I just, in terms of a score, I got obliterated. But at the end of the game, I was like, dude, check out this cool peninsula I made.
Yeah,
it was good. So another question that I think is always interesting to ask designers, because the designer and publisher relationship is something that, unless you have a published game yourself, you don't always quite understand that relationship. And so was there anything that the publisher of Cooper Island, which at least the version that I have is the Capstone version, but it may have been released in Germany and with some other publisher or something. But did the publisher change anything or alter anything that maybe you either were really excited about or weren't really sure about?
So the game was published by a German publisher, a very small publisher called Frosted Games.
Okay.
And they basically do... localizations of games from everywhere in the world, and they do German editions. And when I approached them in 2016, they were thinking about developing games on their own as well, as an addition to localizing games. What did they localize back then? So I don't know. I think I cannot come up with the most famous games they published by now, but they do very much stuff. And but their publishing politics changed after Cooper Island was published. They formed another publisher, and it's called Deep Print Games. New publisher from Germany, and the people behind Frosted Games went on to form this new publisher, and so what Frosted Games became this pure localization company back again. So the people behind this were Victor Kobylka, who is a very skilled editor, and he worked for Eggerspiele before and was involved in games like Mombasa or Great Western Trail. You might know these games.
Yeah, Pfister.
From Pfister, yes. And for instance, Village and something like this. So he's a very, very skilled developer and a very successful developer of board games. And I think to say that they changed something would not be true, because the game is basically what I designed. But maybe you can say they altered some elements of this, like they adjusted how the puzzling works and how the costs are for paying when you use the same space like other players did, and so on. So they made meaningful but small changes, alterations, which is basically part of every development. So yeah, this is basically...
Yeah. Sometimes I hear from designers, you know, that, or let's say there's something about a game that somebody doesn't like, and I'll listen to an interview of that designer talking about, you know, a specific game, and somebody will say, oh, there's this problem with this game, right? Mm-hmm. And then the designer will proceed to say, oh, well, originally the game worked. The game worked this way, but the publisher that I worked with, they thought that it would work better this way, and that's why the game is the way that it is. Mm. And so I'm always curious to you know, ask a designer how that worked for them, and if there was anything that was maybe drastic or you know, instrumental in their game that the publisher changed or had input on.
Yeah, this is always a team effort, you know. But like you know, there's always arguments about stuff like this. You can no board game will be published and everybody was fine with everything. That's not happening.
Yeah.
So there's always the designer who's designed this game and worked on it for years, and it's his baby, and he doesn't want to change stuff, and I am basically the biggest drama queen you can think of. That's yeah, that's basically it. And of course, the publisher has different interests. They know what their aim group is. They know how they want to present the game, and maybe they can shape something into something different, because they think they know they have the knowledge about the market. They know what games will sell and so on. So from this point of view, normally a publisher always looks about business stuff, and most designers, because they are not able to live off designing games, most designers are hobby designers, like I am myself as well. So this is always some kind of, you know, like a baby of them, and I'm not different. So sure, we had arguments, but this is a professional environment, and you have to admit that there are some people who have to make decisions, and
yeah,
this is what happens, and it happens with every game. And of course, I could say that there are some changes being done that I don't like, but I'm pretty certain that they admitted to stuff because they wanted to have a share at this as well, and they were not happy about it because I was saying, no, I don't want you to change it, and they said, okay, we don't change it because he's such a whiny guy and we don't want to deal with this. No, they did not. I'm just exaggerating.
yeah, that's good.
Yeah, in the end, it's always important that you. I'm always about this music things here, because it's basically like a band. When you play in a band, you might not be happy with what the drummer is playing, but it's his. So let him play what he wants to play, and I'm the bassist. I'm responsible for having the sound being big and bassy, and then there's a guitarist. He's not always playing what I like. So, but in the end, we wrote a song together, and the song is pretty cool, and we love to play it. And that's the same with board games. Everybody has a different approach on things, and you have to. Well, in the end, you created a game, and you're proud of it. So it's great.
That's awesome, man. That's a great analogy. And very true. Sometimes those riffs those guys come up with, man, come on.
Yeah. No, that sounds too cheesy. Yeah. Oh, but I love it. I want to play it like this. Yeah. Can you please not play a break every time we do this riff?
Yeah, that's great. So now that the game Cooper Island's been out in the world for a little while now, is there anything that you would go back and change or alter now that, I mean, I know that that's a very hard question, and you know, as like creative people, you probably could just continue like trying to perfect a game forever, right? You could just sit there and like make tweaks forever and ever. And so eventually you have to pull the trigger and put the game out into the world. And like you said, it's not going to appeal to everybody. And there maybe is like a flaw, if you will, but, is there anything like, let's say you could go and make a change to the game and magically it would just apply to every copy that's out in the world. Is there anything that you feel like maybe you would do differently?
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. There might be some things that got changed. For instance, maybe just one thought here. Because I am, you know, everybody has a personal threshold of what can turn a game into what does not feel like a game anymore, but it becomes too much work. I think my threshold for games is a little bit lower, because when I play Cooper Island and I really play for the score, then I go out of the game with a headache. And normally I would not aim for a game that is this brainy. And the publisher changed it a little bit into this more brainy game because they thought that this game should appeal to the diehard optimizing cracks. You know, if you want a game that where you can optimize everything, you optimize this strategy, then the game has to be crunchy. You know, and maybe the game got a little bit too crunchy. Like I said before, half an hour ago or something like this, that the threshold for new players might be a little bit too high, that the game can become too frustrating for new players. And that's maybe something that I would change so that players have better access to the game. And maybe that you do not exclude players that like to play a little bit more out of the guts, that they do not get lost too hard. So maybe a little bit more accessibility would be something that I would aim for, you know. And I think this is also maybe you know, I'm not only a designer, I'm also a player of games or a gamer. And I basically like games better when they are a little bit less crunchy, like Cooper Island. For instance, for me, Underwater Cities is a perfect example. This game is quite heavy, but it's not too brainy. And this is basically the threshold for me, because everything that gets a little bit more complex than a game like Underwater City, this will turn into too much work for me. And then I get a headache after playing it, and that's something I do not enjoy.
Mm. That's really interesting. Coming from you as the designer. That's cool that's the thing that maybe you would alter. It's actually a quality that is endearing for me personally. You know, In the Year of the Dragon might be in my top, whatever, like 10 games. I don't know. I really enjoy tight and challenging and punishing, if you will, games. And so that quality of Cooper Island is something that is attractive to me. And so it's like really cool, really interesting to hear that is something that you would perhaps change about the game.
Yeah, so but let me just say this, because I personally think that the publisher, they knew what they were doing. And when they said that this game, this is so aiming for a typical character of gamer, and you need to satisfy this gamer's wishes. And when you play games like Cooper Island, you want them to be crunchy, you want them to be brainy, and they shape the game into something like this, and maybe a little bit more than I would have wanted, but. Yeah. But hey, this is a team effort, like I said. So they went with their abilities because they knew what they are experienced publishers. Like I said, Viktor Kobylka is one of the most known editors for complex games like Great Western Trail or stuff like this, and he knows his shit, you know, and this is just what he shaped the game into, and he did it for a good reason, and this is part of developing board games.
Yeah, that's great, good stuff. Well, we're we're kind of winding down. My wife's getting supper ready, ready upstairs.
I have to go to bed. I'm losing a whole hour tonight because we're changing the time zone, and I have one hour less to sleep. So we have at some point to finish this here because I need some sleep.
Man, you know what's funny? I was like confused again on the time that we were going to do this because we've already done our daylight savings time thing.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so, like,
2 weeks ago, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, like, time changes are crazy. I'm still trying to figure it out. Anyways, do you, quickly before we end, do you have anything that you are working on right now that you want to talk about? I'm always like, I'm always curious about what designers are doing in between games, you know, like, what are you working on, if anything? And can you share a little bit about it?
This is actually a problem because for the first time I'm working with a really big publisher, and they have some kind of secrecy policy, so I'm not at liberty to say what the next game will be that that will be published from me. So certain game, I cannot tell you something about it, but I can tell you something different because we already announced it last year in October when Spielworks, which is the publisher of La Grania and Solarius Mission, we announced at CodeWorks, which was the online convention of Spielworks, that we are working on a sequel to La Grania.
Mm.
So there will be at some point some kind of, the next iteration of La Grania, and we're working on this right now. This is not the next game that will come out because it's still in a very, very early age stage. And I'm working on this, and I cannot say when this will be coming out because I'm a hobby guy, and it took me 4 years to design Cooper Island. I'm pretty certain that it won't take that long to design a new La Grania game, but there will be a new standalone game in the La Grania universe, you might say.
Awesome. Dude, you know that you've made it when you have a non-disclosure with a publisher, right? You know you've arrived.
Yeah. Yeah, I really like these guys, but I think this is pretty stupid. Because I'm not secretive at all about all everything I do. Is I'm publishing photos of my prototypes normally on social media, because I'm always very I love to share, and it's always something that I do because I am it's actually a security or a safety policy to not be copied.
Yep.
Like I can say, okay, you came up with this? No, I designed this 3 years ago.
Yeah, and everybody knows it.
Everybody knows it. I did this, and this will come out at some point because contracts are already signed. And yeah, this is I'm always about the community. I'm a gamer myself. I'm not a professional board game designer, so I don't care about selling or marketing or stuff like that. That's something that I don't enjoy, coming from a punk rock hardcore background. This is very nuts to me. But let them do their thing. And as soon as there is something that I can talk about, and if you want to have me back, maybe we can talk about it at length. I love to share all the time if you want me to. But in this case, I cannot tell you about it. I'm very sorry.
Nice. No, you don't have to apologize. I get it. So you mentioned social media. If people want to like get in touch with you, want to follow what you are doing and what you can share, where can they go to get a hold of you and see what you're doing?
I have a Facebook page called Ode Spielekiste. It's a German word, so you might not be so keen to find it.
I'll get it and put it in the show notes, so okay, your American friends can find it.
Yeah, but I wanted to say that I'm not so much on Facebook anymore. I still have my account, but I normally use Facebook only to stay in contact with old friends and know where the people I went to school with are now in this world, and this is basically what I use Facebook for. But if you want to get in touch, and then you can use Instagram or Twitter, which I'm using for showing pictures of everything except for right now. But I'm also publishing for pictures of what I play all the time, because me and my wife, we play all the time. And yeah, it's not only fun, it's also research, because I'm always, I always want to play all the stuff that comes out, and I try to, but there's just too many games, man. It's not doable, but I try, and you can always get in touch and ask my opinion about stuff, and or tell me what if you like or do not like my games. I always love to learn from people. I'm happy to know what people like and what they don't like. And yeah, I'm not in it for the money, so I'm in it for the fun of it. And so let's have a good chat.
Awesome, man. That sounds great. Well, you sold me on Underwater Cities. I'm going to have to pick up a copy now. I was actually, I didn't have it high on my list simply because there was a podcast that I really enjoyed, and they were under the impression that there was a like overpowered strategy, if you will, that was a problem in the game. And I have a hard time with that. I think I still care too much about winning. And so when I know that there is a certain path that, you know, is overpowered, then it's it's difficult for me to stay away from that, right? Mm-hmm. And so I didn't have it high up on my priority list, but I think you sold me. So you might need like some royalties or something from them.
You know, let me just tell you that this game, the strategies are perfectly balanced. Everything is nice. Balanced. It's, if somebody is telling you that heavy cap is too strong, they are talking out of their ass.
Okay, so you've heard the chatter as well.
That's totally not true. That's
okay.
That's you know, I don't know if you have the time for this, but I can explain basically this technique of balancing games to you, and that's also being done with Underwater Cities. So all strategies in Underwater Cities are perfectly balanced, but if you want to have high replayability in a game, you always take certain stuff out of it. So in Underwater Cities, there are scoring cards for the game end, and there's always six cards in the game out of I think it's 12 or 14 cards, I don't know. So some things are being rewarded heavily and some things are not. So since each path in the game is perfectly balanced out, there's six cards in the game that reward certain paths in the game. So it's basically true that each game of Underwater Cities is unbalanced, because some of the paths in the game are just better because the scoring cards are out there. What you have to do as a player is to find this path and to play it the way it needs to be played. Of course, there are certain games of Underwater Cities where heavy kelp is too strong, because there's two scoring cards in the game that give you benefits when you play heavy kelp. The question is, do I get these cards or do the other players claim them and I cannot have them? Because this is also a game that has very high interaction, because if I let you claim all the stuff that you need for your strategy, of course you will win because I played shit. It's just the way this game is working. And if you leave this player this path open so he can follow it, he will win, or she. And that's basically what this game is all about. You have to read the green in this game, and then you see, okay, this might be the best strategy in this game. I go for it. And if you succeed to do so, and the other players are not seeing what you're doing, and this what you're doing is very good, then you will win. But if you're not doing it well, and maybe the other players they don't let you get all the stuff that you need for doing this, then you will not win. And this is basically how the game is balanced, and how the game provides incredibly high replayability, because every game is different and every play of this game is broken in a different way. And that's why these talks and these discussions online are always happening, because of course there are some games that were broken in favor of kelp, but the next game is not. And if you play the next game the same way with a heavy kelp strategy, you will lose to a city building strategy maybe, or something like this. It also always depends on what the setup of the game is giving you, and it's depending on what the other players let you do. And so the game, so each strategy in this game is perfectly balanced. It just depends. And that's it's a balancing strategy that many Eurogame designers by now do. And it's just a way of designing games. And each game is broken, but the next game is broken differently. It's basically a technique of balancing games. Leave it up to the players to find the best strategy.
That's good. Yeah. No, that makes total sense. When you were talking, another game that came to mind was Teotihuacan. And there's a couple like the Path of the Dead track. The first time I played that game, I was like, dude, this is like, you gotta hit this, and if you don't, you're gonna lose. But what's interesting is that once the other players understand that there's a lot of potential there, then people start, you know, fighting over that space, and then it becomes less valuable, and then that changes how the game plays. So, letting the players kind of work that balance out is certainly an approach to designing. So, That's good.
Yeah, it's the lazy approach to designing. Yeah, because you leave it to the players to balance the game. That's incredibly lazy. And I really cannot stress this enough. You cannot leave the balance of the game to the players. And you can always say, yeah, you just have to find out how the game is balanced. Well, no, I'm just joking. Because normally, the technique is that all strategies are balanced, but you just have to find out in this play what is the strongest, and then you can aim for it.
Yeah,
and you might even think, oh, this is the strongest, and I'm going heavy on it, and then you find out, oh no, it was not too strong because, I did not play it. Yeah,
exactly. Well, I'm gonna have to check it out. Well, man, this has been super rad. You gotta get to bed. I smell the food. I smell it. Okay. So I'm getting hungry. But Oda, it was super good. I really appreciate you coming on the show. It's a good time.
Yeah, thank you very much for this nice discussion. It was very cool talking to you.
Good, man.
And give my best to your wife and have in Germany we say guten Appetit,
which good means appetite. Enjoy the food.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, good. Well, listeners. Thank you for joining us. I hope that you enjoyed your time and were able to take something out of this and use it in your own life, use it in your game designs that you might be working on. And if you did have a good time, there's a lot of ways that you can show some love. Go comment on the podcast discussion page. Tell us what you thought of this episode. Tell us about all of the things that you love and hate about Cooper Island. The love list I know is going to be exponentially larger than the hate list, but it's interesting regardless. So, join the Facebook group if you're not a part of that already. There's some cool people over there. Comment on and rate this podcast on whatever platform you listen to it on, and finally sign up for the mailing list, which is probably the most important of all of these things for me. It allows me to get in touch directly with you as a listener and as part of this community. So, and if you just want to reach out and say what's up, you can find me on all of the social medias, or you can send me an email, which is on the blog, hexandcube.com. Thanks again. And remember, don't put all of your eggs in one basket unless you have like a really big basket or like a wagon that you can carry them in. Peace.
This is the way.